Hey, and welcome again to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard with the stories behind rock's best.
You're welcome. Guitar up. One, two, three.
Today in the studio, the sound that began as a murmur slowly builds to monstrous proportions, both popular but also important worldwide. What's the frequency, can at this
young thing's a dream? Yeah, I always think it's really funny that people always underestimate the intelligence of their audiences, and yet we sell a huge amount of records, and we don't give our audiences a break one way or another, and we don't repeat the formula. We're doing this tour now, and we're doing tons of songs that they haven't heard. We're doing five or six brand new songs in the set. And, you know, nobody complains about that to me. I talk to kids all the time, and they think it's cool. If you believe, they put a man on the moon.
The process of trying to become a three-piece was just so much more difficult than we ever imagined it would be.
Really?
Well, you just don't know what... I mean, I still can't put my finger on exactly what we had to go through when Bill left. I mean, the whole point of the whole thing of trying to rebuild, rediscover the dynamic between three people was just because it's like walking through the woods in the dark with no map or no flashlight. You just don't know where you're going, and you know you don't know which direction to take or why you should take any one direction over another. Everybody hurts
sometimes. Now, this is the first time in 23 years that we've looked backward rather than forward and reflected back on what we've done. And it does, for me, provide kind of closure of REM as a four-piece. I feel that our confidence level as a trio is to the same level as that we had in our best moments as a four-piece. And so, on a personal note, I'm able to kind of close that chapter with some regret because I miss Bill Barry, although I'm very happy for him as a farmer. But close that chapter and open the next one. And I'm very interested in where the next one's going to take us.
Hi, this is Mike Mills, and you're just in time for the best of REM.
Hi, this is Peter Buck. Welcome back to In the Studio with Redbeard.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe, and you're just in time for the best of REM 1988 to 2003 In the Studio, Part 2.
I must admit, some initial disappointment when I saw only one song from the Out of Time album on the REM Best Of In Time, 1988 to 2003. But on further thought, REM's self-aware philosophy was probably revealed. They figured that 10 million of us already own the songs on the Out of Time album, and the band would have no part in taking our money for the same songs all over again when they could use the new CD to share some lesser-known but equally deserving songs. It's precisely this self-consciousness that has driven more than one record producer, publicist, and video producer to pull their hair out by the roots when trying to get the individuals within REM to play ball. As the band's star rose, and with 1991's Out of Time, the star went into supernova. And to the chagrin of virtually everyone outside of the band, REM, at the peak of their popularity, decided not to tour. And when it came time to follow up that 10 million seller, instead of taking their pick of superstar producers, REM decided to dance with the one that brung them. Here's REM guitarist Peter Buck.
It's really funny because starting a band, I mean, nobody helps you, you know, generally. I mean, your parents don't want you to do it. The club owners don't want you to be in their club giving them the demo tape. Nobody wants you to do it. So you have to have this great self-confidence and ability to really push yourself. So I find it really shocking that then people signed a record deal and didn't let people make decisions for them. Because I know what I'm doing. I mean, I've done this a lot longer than most people have done their job. And I've certainly been around REM more than, you know, and I know what we should do. It's great when people give us suggestions that you know, we work with Scott Litt a lot, and he always helps us, but he doesn't tell us, well, you know, you'll sell a million records if you do this. He always just says, yeah, this would be pretty wild. Let's try it. And I'm really interested in experimenting. I just don't want to have a formula that to follow. I mean, although the English record company people used to say that, like, around the time of Murmur, that dance music was big in England, so we really need to do more of a dance record. And I was like, well, you know, I'm not really sure what you expect us to do in the way of making a dance record. I mean, we're kind of a folk rock band from Georgia. I mean, you know, I just don't really get it. Well, it's really short-sighted. we've always felt that, well, we're going to be around in 10 years. We don't have to have a hit tomorrow. And so many of the record company people want a hit today because that's their job. I understand that. It's a business, and I do the business. You know, I'm in it. I'm involved in it. My business is different from their business. My business is that this is something I do, and I do it well, and I'd probably do it for another 10. So it's not imperative to me to have a hit. And if we put out a record that is something we really want to do and it doesn't sell as well as the previous one, which Automatic didn't sell as well as Out of Time. I mean, it sold 8 million instead of 10 million. But that's fine. You know, I mean, I accept the fact that, well, you know, it didn't sell as well, but it's the record we wanted to make. And it wasn't a real commercial record. It was just a pretty great record. There's a guy in an office somewhere that's checking off figures that knows that, you know. Well, I don't care. I mean, it doesn't bother me. But when we did Automatic, there wasn't a guarantee that it would sell 8 million either. I mean, it was a substantially uncommercial record. And, you know, except for the fact that it was us, if that had been a band's first record, it would have been on the radio at all.
Monopoly 21, checkers and chess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mr. Fred Lassie in a breakfast mess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Let's play Twister, let's play Risk. Yeah, 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 yeah. I'll see you in heaven if you make. About this one, tell me, are you locked in the pines? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis, baby? Are we losing touch? If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe
Like so many things REM, that song Man on the Moon would turn out to be a most unconventional hit song in November 1992. Originally on the album Automatic for the People, REM lyricist and lead singer Michael Stipe reveals how creativity inspires others.
It was the last week in the studio, and I had this piece of music that the band really loved, and they'd recorded everything that they could record without a vocal, and they really pushed me too far, actually, to just write the damn thing and be done with it. And I'd had the song for a year at that point, and I just put on the Walkman and I walked around Seattle until something came to me. And I went into the studio, sang the song, sang the backup part, brought Mike in and Bill, had them sing another backup part, and that was that. We mixed it and we sent it to the record company within 2 days, and didn't even know what we'd done. You know, it was just a song that came out of me like that. I didn't intend to write a song about Andy Kaufman. I didn't even know that I was even thinking about him still. But a friend of mine, Mark Williams, who I can credit with showing me a videotape of Kaufman's work, and he was a fan from the 1970s, and he'd gotten his hands on this incredibly obscure videotape. Mark was also the guy who called Jay Boberg at IRS Records in the early 1980s and said, there's a band from Georgia that you should really check out. And so, in effect, he helped us a great deal towards landing our first record contract. I'd credit him with helping us write that song, because in my unconscious were these forgotten images of this tremendous performer who had no fear as a comedian and as a performer, and stepped off a bunch of cliffs himself, and that went into that song, and the song was born. Years later, somebody heard the song and thought it might make a good biopic to write about Andy Kaufman's life, and that's how that movie happened. I think it started with someone hearing the song.
Not touring in the first half of the 90s may not have impacted REM sales, but it did seem to influence their style of writing on Automatic for the People, according to Peter Buck.
We haven't toured in a while. When we started this tour, we went back and played some old stuff, and it kind of made me realize how good the songs were. You know, because you do the records, and you always, every record you do, everyone in this end of the business thinks they've made a great record. Nobody means to make a bad one. Nobody tries to make a mediocre record. You know, they do the very best they can, and you'd be less than human if you didn't fool yourself a little bit and think that they were maybe better than they are, or at least you hope they are. And so when we go back and play them, I actually kind of go, gosh, you know, these are really good songs. They hold up. We always like to think that we know what we're doing when we start, but that's just not the way it works for anybody, I don't think. Generally, when we've written about 20 songs, and we're kind of at the point where we start realizing which ones are good and which ones aren't. And probably that means a couple weeks into the studio work. And then you start realizing, oh, okay, this record's going to be, like with Automatic, we were in the studio when we realized that it was going to be a quiet record. We think we still thought it was going to be a rock record. And then we realized that, well, the rockers weren't going to make it. And the stuff that seemed the most emotionally real was the quieter things. And especially at the very, very end, the last couple of weeks, when you start defining it, doing all the mixing things, a lot of times you just get slapped in the face with what you've done, because until then you don't really know.
Smack, crap, bush, whack, tie another one to the rat, baby. Rock and roll, nobody tells you where to go, baby. What if I ride? What if you walk? What if you rock around the clock? Tick, top, tick, top. What if you did? What if you walk? What if you try to get off, baby? Shake a leg, maybe you're crazy in the head, baby.
Originally a funeral dirge on 1992's Automatic for the People, the addition of electricity in that live Greenpeace version boils off all sneering cynicism of the original. You can find that one now, included on the second disc of Rarities and B-Sides, on the special edition of In Time, the best of REM 1988 to 2003. Up next, Michael Stipe and Mike Mills tell why REM sings the TV Anchorman blues. I'm Redbeard in the studio, and you're just in time for the best of REM Part 2.
Hi, this is Mike Mills, and you're just in time for the best of REM 1988-2003 in the studio Part 2.
Thanks, Mike. Try this concept out. If CD sales for the albums Out of Time and Automatic for the People in America were the same as a vote for president, then REM would come in a tie for third behind Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. in the U.S. presidential election. By the time of Monsters' Fall 94 release, REM was playfully invigorated and rocking again, with a song inspired by CBS TV news anchor Dan Rather getting mugged while his assailant muttered, "What's the frequency, Kenneth?" Here's first Michael Stipe, then Mike Mills of REM.
I met Dan Rather. He's a fan of the band, and we actually sang together. He sang part of What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with REM. He's a very, very smart man, and he's very funny, and he has a very wicked sense of self as an anchorman, I think, and as a celebrity, and also as a person who has his own ideas outside of his job. And it was a great pleasure to meet him. The song title was really it has nothing to do with the song. It's more of an indicator. It's a pop culture reference that in the song is misunderstood or completely goes over the head of the protagonist. And that's what the song is about, is some attempt at jumping a generation gap or understanding something about a younger generation that just goes hopelessly pear-shaped and I'm a little brutal on the guy, but that's what inspired it.
Mike Mills of REM.
We did meet Dan. He's a fan of the band, and I actually really like Dan Rather. I always liked him anyway, but then it turns out that he likes the band. He loved the fact that we used that phrase. I think what happened is pretty much as reported. I mean, he got mugged, and as they were pounding on him, they kept asking him, "What's the frequency, Kenneth? What's the frequency?" And so he, I guess we did a very odd thing. You know, he and Letterman are buddies. So we were doing, he was going to be on Letterman. So he came down to soundcheck. I guess it was when we played The Garden last time. And he came down to soundcheck and they brought a camera crew. And he sort of sang, might not really be the applicable word here, but he got up and we did Kenneth with him. And they showed it on the Letterman show. And it was, you know, one of your stranger marriages of an anchor man and a rock band. And but he was game, and, you know, we were willing, and it turned out to be this really funny little thing. But I think it left a lot of people scratching their heads, including us.
What's the frequency, Kenneth? This y'all been so drained. I'm
Monster album. That's What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Now on In Time, the best of REM, 1988 to 2003. The Monster Tour of 95, though, should have been sponsored by an HMO, as it turns out. Drummer Bill Berry suffered a sudden brain aneurysm and had emergency life-saving surgery in Switzerland. 6 weeks later, Mike Mills and Michael Stipe would be hospitalized with intestinal surgery and hernia operations, respectively. Yet somehow, all three recover and complete the tour successfully. But in 1997, drummer Bill Berry decides to leave REM. Mike Mills tries to explain that impact.
The process of trying to become a three-piece was just so much more difficult than we ever imagined it would
really?
Be. Well, you just don't know what – I mean, I still can't put my finger on exactly what we had to go through when Bill left. I mean, the whole point of – the whole thing of trying to rebuild rediscover the dynamic between three people – was just because it's like walking through the woods in the dark with no map or no flashlight. You just don't know where you're going, and you don't know which direction to take or why you should take any one direction over another. And I mean, it's really, you're just sort of fumbling around. But given our stubborn nature, we plowed on full speed ahead right into the next record, and without taking any time to try to assess what had just happened to us, we just went ahead and did it. Which work is therapy, and there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think Bill's departure affected our writing too much because in the last many years, I say, especially since Peter moved to Seattle in early 91 or whenever it was, we've been writing kind of separately anyway, as opposed to the days when we all lived in the same place where we were always hanging out, we were always writing together. As people become adults or whatever, I think you tend to retreat more into yourself in terms of writing, or at least we did. And so Peter and I were always writing on our own anyway. So I don't think Bill's departure changed the writing too much. One thing Bill was really good at for us was editing. He kept the songs shorter and as they should be. So that's something we've had to learn to do without Bill, is to edit ourselves and not to get self-indulgent. Because we've always appreciated the beauty of a concise, 3 to 4 minute pop song, and and I think that that's essential. And sometimes you can lose sight of that. You don't want to become art damaged and start putting 7 minute prog rock songs on there. So Bill was always real good at keeping that from happening.
When your day is long. This
slide. Days and nights are long. When you think you've had too much, let the slide to hang on. Well, everybody hurts.
Simply a magnificent song. Originally on 1992's Automatic for the People, that's called Everybody Hurts. British magazine Uncut says of singer-lyricist Michael Stipe, and we quote, "In person, he often strikes people as shy, eccentric, remote, disconnected. Here is responsible for one of rock's great moments of empathy and connection with a mass audience," end quote. And I might add, you can also do the original line dance, The Stroll, to it. I'm Redbeard. Up next, Mike Mills, Peter Buck, and Michael Stipe all return in the studio for In Time, the Best of REM, Part 2.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe, and you're just in time for the Best of REM 1988 to 2003 in the studio, Part 2.
Thank you, Michael. Mike Mills and I were reminiscing about the days when the entire REM catalog consisted of Chronic Town and Murmur, my favorite, and how Peter Buck, Mike, and I did our first radio interview on the Reckoning album tour in 1984. I wondered aloud if Mike Mills could have imagined these Hall of Fame days back then.
You know, I've never probably imagined it because I just didn't really care to. I didn't think that far ahead. I mean, we were never a band that had grand schemes or goals, you know, particularly. We were a band that always knew what we didn't want to do. You know,
and what was that?
Well, we didn't want to do anything that felt wrong, just as a general feeling. I mean, Peter was enough of a rock and roll archivist even at that point, and I'd read a fair amount myself, and we had an idea of what looked bad and what was bad and what some of the pitfalls could be. In terms of the advice you take from people, thoughts on what you have to do to become successful. So we sort of took everything on a case-by-case basis, and we never had these long-range plans for anything. So, no, I never imagined that 20 years on I'd be doing it with the same guys, but I never imagined I wouldn't either. You know, I always knew I'd be playing music in some form or fashion, and
I think that's the most significant thing, probably, is that you knew that you were going to make music your life.
Right, yeah. Well, it became pretty obvious pretty quickly I wasn't really suited for much else.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. Simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to the one I love. fire. A fire. This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prod to occupy my time. But this one goes out to the one I love. A fire. This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. Another prod has occupied my time. This one goes out to the one I love. Fire.
It's True Nature. That's a straightforward reading of R.E.M.'s The One I Love from a 2001 performance at Manhattan's Museum of Television and Radio on 52nd Street, which is open to the public Tuesday through Friday in New York City. It should surprise no one that much of this interview was also done there. You see, from its very genesis, R.E.M. has existed on the gravitas of knowledge, creativity, and communication. Here's Peter Buck.
Yeah, I always think it's really funny that people always underestimate the intelligence of their audiences, and yet we sell a huge amount of records, and we don't give our audiences a break one way or another. I mean, we don't repeat the formula. We're doing this tour now, and we're doing tons of songs that they haven't heard. We're doing 5 or 6 brand new songs in the set. And, you know, nobody complains about that to me. I talk to kids all the time, and they think it's cool, you know, that we're doing new songs. Maybe not every single one of them, but our fans do. And if you make records for anyone other than yourself, then you make it for your hardcore fans who are excited by new things.
Here's Michael Stipe of REM.
It's very loud and chaotic and kind of fucked up sounding, and it's just it's a very big song. It's my favorite song right now to play live. I usually enjoy the newer ones a real lot because I'm kind of throwing myself off a cliff every time I open my mouth with them. But it's treading familiar ground for REM fans, I think, in that the song is about instinct and my perception of our forgetting how to trust ourselves on a very instinctual level over the course of the last 100 or 150 years or 200 years. And that's something that I very optimistically hope that the 21st century brings us back into. And I think it will, with the help of technology and several other things that we've created, some good, some not so good. I think it will come kind of screeching back in a very big and positive way.
She's a sad tomato. She's her own invention.
She's her own invention.
That gets me in throat. What can I make myself be? Life is strange.
Yeah, life is strange.
What can I make myself be?
That writer Rob Sheffield put it best in Rolling Stone magazine recently when he wrote, and we quote, "The rock world of today is so much like the one that REM were rebelling against 20 years ago. Once again, radio was full of metal gomers who never met a rule they didn't obey. And once again, REM are totally out of step with the times." Michael Stipe of REM.
Over the course of 23 years, being politicized simply by the amount of travel that we've done as a band, when those moments come, I feel like the opportunity is lost if I don't say something or if I don't try to capture that time. It's an interesting time for the U.S., certainly, and one that we'll see if, as we all think, everything has sped up in the course of our lifetimes, let's say since mid-century, 1950s. Certainly my grandmother's being born in 1904 without a television or a motor vehicle and dying 87 years later with a man on the moon and nuclear abilities on each side of the line. Who knows what it'll be when I'm 87.
I don't know why you mean to me. When I call on the telephone, and I don't know what you mean to me. But I want to turn you on. We'll be right back.
here is my appeal. I need a chance, a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, a word, a signal, not a little breath, just to fool myself, catch myself, make it real.
I think politics might speed up in the cycles that politics go through in American politics, certainly because it's very much celebrity and media fueled and driven, might speed up so that what would take 8 years to come full cycle to move from one extreme to the other, and that's really basically how it moves, I think, might move down into a 4 or even a 2 year cycle.
Well, no, that brings up, goes right into my next point, and that is...
George W. Bush one-termer? Possibly. It really depends on the economy, and that's what it's down to.
If you can see yourself now, baby, it's not my fault. It used to be so in control. You're no, 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 you bang, bang.
until just a couple of years ago, it was the same four guys, and now it's the same three guys in REM. How does REM be the exception to this shortening of the cycle of so many things that you've just mentioned?
I certainly didn't think that a decision that I made at the age of 15, that I would be talking with people who were interested in hearing what I had to say about it in my early 40s, much less that I would have the fortune that I and we have had with this band.
What do you ascribe it to?
And the challenges that it's presented to me in my life, ranging from the very public to the very personal, some brilliant, some terrifying, some life-altering, some not. But I wake up every morning thinking, well, I didn't this morning because I had to get up early to do this, but I wake up every morning thinking that I'm a very, very lucky person.
What do you ascribe the longevity to?
Peter and Mike were really encyclopedic about music and musicians and the biographies of the people who they really admired as music fans. And they kind of very smartly said, if we're going to do this, these are the things that we need to know. This is what breaks up bands. This is what makes people start to suck. This is what makes people formulaic and irrelevant. And we knew that from the beginning. One of those things was releasing a greatest hits package or a live record when you've run out of things to say or when the creative juices have stopped flowing. And I can't say, in our case, certainly, this is the first time in 23 years that we've looked backward rather than forward and reflected back on what we've done. And it does, for me, provide kind of closure of REM as a four-piece. I feel that our confidence level as a trio is to the same level as that we had in our best moments as a four-piece. And so, on a personal note, I'm able to kind of close that chapter with some regret because I miss Bill Berry, although I'm very happy for him as a former. But close that chapter and open the next one. And I'm very interested in where the next one's going to take us.
I've watched the stars fall silent from your eyes. All the sights that I have seen. System. There is nothing up my sleeve. I'm pushing an elephant up the stairs. I'm tossing up punchlines that were never there. Over my shoulder a piano falls, crashing to the ground. In all this talk of time, talk is fine. Can't we pantomime, just close our eyes and sleep sweet dreams, me and you with wings on our feet? I'm pushing an elephant up the stairs. I'm tossing up punchlines that were never there. Over my shoulder a piano falls, we'll be right back. too.